Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, August 19, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on prn.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today you will hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we got another great show for you today that will include, can your attitude actually affect your genes?
And who regulates food additives?
Should the FDA speed approval for certain cancer drugs?
And are test tube burgers good for vegetarians?
Wow, are they good for anybody? And can sleep deprivation lead to junk food cravings?
Don't worry. Be happy. Your genes may thank you for it. But what is real happiness? I mean, does it count if you're popular and you have a lot of material things? Or is there a difference if you see the cup half full and feel good from helping others? Researchers show that different types of happiness actually have different effects on our genes.
I think it's amazing, Vicki, at how Mother Nature is so organized in what she does. And how the little things in life seem to make such a big difference in how our body works. And when we're looking at how our attitude is and how it affects our genes and the type of happiness we have, it's amazing that they turn out to be different.
I know. Even though you feel happy or you feel good, if what's causing that particular happiness isn't, according to this study, then it's not doing any good for your genes, but it's good for your mind, I guess.
Well, they're comparing two kinds of happiness. One is where you're satisfying yourself. You're more narcissistic in what you do. It's about accumulating things and having power. And if you're like that, you'll be happy, all right. But the effect on your genes is much different than if you're giving and loving and sharing, and that makes you happy.
Because that's healthier. And we always talk about how having a meaningful purpose in life is part of living a healthy lifestyle.
No question at all. But here we have the actual proof. And the proceedings of the National Academies of Science in July of 2013, they did a study that was between the University of California in Los Angeles and University of North Carolina. And what they did is they looked at these two different kinds of happiness and measured them in 80 healthy adults. And what they did is they divided them into the group that was hedonistic and the group that was really giving. And what they found was is they both had the same level of happiness, but they didn't have the same level of well-being because of effects on the immune system and on inflammation.
Well, you know what I thought was interesting, too, is how it causes less inflammation, and it even works like against viruses and antibodies.
So if you're being generous and you're giving and loving and sharing, the effects on your immune system are that you have less inflammation. You can measure the inflammatory markers, and they did. And you can also look at the effect of antibody production itself and against viruses.
So Mother Teresa must have been pretty healthy.
Well,
she died.
Well, yeah, everybody's got to go, Vicki.
Yeah.
And I don't think there would be too many people who would say that she didn't have a meaningful purpose in her life that was good for the world.
I'll say, but you know, sometimes when people are upset about things or things happen in their lives that are stressful, they go out and they go shopping because that makes them feel good.
That's more hedonistic.
But that's helping their minds more than their genes, because I guess what would be the best thing to do is that if you're upset about something, to go out and help somebody else.
Or how about going shopping for somebody else?
Yeah.
I know you've done things like that. Where you've collected things and given them to people who need it. And you've had some coats, I remember in the past, that were new, that you never wore, that you gave to people who were homeless.
Well, one time I saw a girl that was on the street, and she had a sign. I think she had her child with her, and she was cold, or she said something about being cold. And so I went home, and I got this coat that I'd bought that I'd really never worn, and I went back and I gave it to her. And it really did make me feel good.
How did it make her feel, too?
Oh, I'm sure it made her. She was very happy.
You've also done other kinds of giving that really impressed me. I know that I play used to play a lot of tennis, and I had a whole bunch of old shoes that were for years that I never threw out. They weren't quite worn out. but there were also shoes that we didn't need. And so you'd take these big boxes of shoes and you'd go to the, was it near the BART station?
Yeah, I just walk up Powell Street and some of the
San Francisco,
yeah, and market and stuff, and I'd find hopeless people and give them shoes. But, you know, the things personally that have made me feel the best were things that I did, like with pastoral care, when I would go to the hospital and visit patients there, mm-hmm. and just give them the gift of my time. Because when I would leave, I would just feel really good. I mean, I'd feel like I had wings, you know.
Well, you probably do.
But it just really made me feel good. I know I was making them feel good, but the best reward was, you know, for myself. And I know, even like you were talking about giving gifts, that when I give gifts, really, it's much more exciting, like on Christmas or something, to watch everybody else them than to open my own. I remember one year somebody said to me, "Why don't you open yours?" And it was like, "Oh, yeah."
Right. I have gifts, too.
But it was more fun to watch everybody
else. Well, that's part of one of the reasons why you're such a good nurse.
It's why I'm so healthy.
Well, that, too. And I know just being in the field of medicine itself, it should be more about giving and sharing and helping. But what's happened is even these wonderful people who go into medicine with the intent of serving humanity come out 8 or 10 or 15 years later kind of jaded because of the way they're treated during their training. And they don't have that same spark that they had when they went into training. I know because I've seen this in so many of my colleagues.
Yeah, but you're not like that. You're very giving. In fact, you're so generous, you're almost generous to ridiculousness.
Is there a way to make it ridiculous?
But I know it really makes you feel good to do it.
Well, you know, somebody comes in the office, they save their money. Maybe they've heard me on a radio show or on the internet or some talk that I've given someplace. And they come and see me thinking that I'm going to solve their problem in one visit. So they've saved up a few hundred dollars to pay for the visit. And then they come in and they find out what's really involved. And they don't have enough money to come back. And a lot of them don't have insurance at all. What are you to do? You're going to say, "Well, I'm sorry you don't have enough money. Go save your money and come back and I'll give you an office visit."
Oh, I remember one time you volunteered to do to care for people in a clinic that was voluntary.
I remember
you were
that.
Donating your time to it, and things didn't work out so well there, and you came back to your office, and those patients followed you there.
Well,
and you were planning to treating them all for free because it was
right.
for people that were homeless and
well, this
and
was the oddest thing.
So
people's
forth.
Personalities get in the way. I was donating my time at a church. I'm not going to say which one. And it was only one day a week. It was on a Monday. And I'd go in there and spend the day with the photon stimulator helping people who had pain. And we had lots of people who had all kinds of problems. And, of course, treating pain is a wonderful thing to do because it makes people so much more functional. But it was about the attention and the time and the sharing and the listening, okay, and caring.
Just being with them.
Just being with them. But the equipment took up a little bit of space. And the director of the clinic was just crazy. I mean, he didn't like the idea.
I think he was jealous.
Well, he probably was.
Because everybody wanted to see you. They were all lined up to see you, but they weren't lined up to see him.
Yeah,
and you were helping all these people.
And they were all getting
pain.
Better. And a lot of the other patients were there were seeing what was happening, saying, "Well, I want to switch over to Dr. Saputo." And he got, I guess that you're right, he probably got jealous. And he said he didn't like the idea of using a treatment that was unconventional. That at the time it was using the infrared light therapy. So I picked up my stuff and left, and I mean, that was – and all the patients that I had, every
they
single
were crying.
One of them.
They were crying in the halls, first of all. You didn't mention that part.
Yeah, and they came to my office until they all got well. I mean, every single one of them got better.
And who did that make feel the best?
Yeah, well, certainly made me feel good.
Yeah.
And you're not always appreciated by people. I mean, there are a lot of things that we do where we take a risk. It's like almost going into a labyrinth and thinking you're going to find your way out because you find out about a new technology. When I found out about infrared light therapy, I read about it in this magazine, and it sounded ridiculous to me because I thought, how could this possibly be in the practice of medicine? Because if this was true, everybody'd want to use it. And it turned out the fellow lived close to where we live, and I gave him a call. And I said, "Why do you print stuff like that? It can't really be true." And he said, "Well, you're like everybody else, you know, at least you called." He said, "Why don't you bring a couple of patients by and we'll go ahead and take, you know, we'll see if this works, you know, for their pain." So I brought two people who were pretty advanced with their pain, and we spent about an hour treating the two of them together, and they got better. And then, he says, would you like to do more of this? And I was surprised that those two people got better, you know, even if it was just temporary.
And it was like, sure, prove it to me.
Yeah. So he said, well, I have time if you have time. And I said, okay, how about if I come after work on Mondays and Wednesdays and Fridays from 5 to 7, and I'll bring two or three patients with me, and we'll treat them. And he said, fine, that's okay. We did it for 3 months. Most of the people got better. And then he looked at me and said, well, what do you think now, Mr. Smart Guy? You think it works? I said, yeah. Now, that was 15 years ago. And, of course, I'm still doing it. But the surprising thing is most other people, most other doctors don't believe that. And they don't even believe their patients when they have a neuropathy, say, that's painful, or they've got a disc that's really incapacitating them, or some other kind of problem like fibromyalgia, and they're getting better from it. They don't believe it. And they don't call, and they don't ask. But when a few people have come by and I've mentored them, as I have some of the students from UCSF and from other colleges around, they don't want to go back because they say, you do so many things that are different, and the infrared light therapy blows my mind. I said, well, you're just going to have to go back and get your degree. And if you're really then convinced that this is such a good thing, then you can come back and talk to me. And we'll see about getting you into practice doing them.
I remember when you were first doing it, and you would come home every day and tell me stories. And it was like little miracles were happening every day.
Yeah.
And that was, you got so much reward from that. I mean, when you think about it, when you do photon stimulator treatments, most doctors, if they had the equipment and they believed in it, they would have trained somebody else to do it and wouldn't be doing it themselves. And people love having the attention and that relationship with their doctor.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that you're getting something out of
that. Oh, tremendously. I've always wanted a magic wand. And this is kind of like a magic wand. It just erases pain. I know that I gave a setup. A photon stimulation setup to another doctor who was an orthopedic doctor in my area, and said, try it for a month and see what it does. And he did, and I called him back in a month and said, what'd you find out? He says, well, it doesn't work. I said, what do you mean it doesn't work? I said, what did you do? He said, well, I gave it to my nurse and told her to do the best she could with it and see if she could fix somebody. And I said, come on, tell me the truth. What really happened? You know this works. And he said, well, if you have to know the truth, I make a lot of money when I give an injection or I do a procedure on somebody.
Oh, and he admitted that?
He admitted it. And he said that I can only make, you know, something like $25 for the use of the technology you use. I can't make a living doing that.
For the insurance.
Yeah. So there are all kinds of different ways that we get our happiness.
And you know, we have a friend in Argentina, and we went to visit him, and he's just like the sweetest, nicest guy in the world, and he's extremely generous, and he was so good to us, and we had brought a photon stimulator with us, and you ended up helping patients. Yeah, but first you were helping patients in his clinic because he's a surgeon. You were helping his patients.
I was working more than half time there on my vacation helping
these
people.
But you weren't loving it. That was my whole point, was that you were loving it. And then he had a friend that had an accident. We were going over to his house and helping him.
Oh, some broken ribs, yeah.
And then you ended up just leaving it with him to, you know, for his own use. And he has still been thanking you for that for a couple of years.
Well, he understands it.
But anyway, this wonderful giving is good for your own genes. So everybody needs to do it and find out how it makes you feel better.
Well, it's what's wrong with our culture.
Well, make people feel better in their genes. See, it gets right down to the root of health.
Well, there's no question about that part. And really what it boils down to is that the study that they did showed that doing good and feeling good are two different things and have different effects on the human genome. So if we give it with the right spirit, with the right intention, what happens is your levels of inflammation go down, and you also have an immune system that can respond much more quickly and effectively.
So we need to focus on seeing the cup half full, too.
Sure, I think that's right. But don't get the idea of doing things just for that reason. I mean, what's wrong with America and with the rest of the world is that we're profit-driven. We're after materialism. We're after having power or being somebody who's very famous. And what we should be thinking about is, what are the ways I can give to make the world a better place? And if you really participate that way and you set the example, you're just one person. But maybe another person will notice it.
Plus, you're also getting brownie points for upstairs.
Upstairs. Well, that's true. But it shouldn't, again, be for that reason. The reason should be because it's right and because there's a joy in giving.
Well, that's a good reason. Why would that not be right?
Well, I think that's okay, but not everybody thinks that way. I mean, I don't want to force your religious or my religious beliefs on somebody else. But I do think that when we are that way, it makes the world a better place. And it makes me feel good to be able to help somebody who otherwise might not be able to be helped. And that's what being a doctor for me is about. It's not so much about the money that I make, because I don't make that much money. I give too many things away. If I was going to be a businessman, I'd be terrible.
The other thing is, sometimes if I do something nice for somebody that hasn't been nice to me.
Oh, yeah, that's the best.
It almost makes me feel like I've one-upped them.
Oh, well, I don't feel that way so much. What I feel like in that setting is I can help somebody who has lots of problems that come out in a way that irritate a lot of people, including me. But I can go past that. And if I go past that, I can turn an enemy into a friend. And that's making the world also a better place, because we should be centered around what we can give and share and take and love in a way that's supporting.
Well, you see, it's being bigger than what they're being.
Well, yeah, but it's yes, that's true. And yet it's not a competition.
Yeah, I didn't mean it in that way anyway.
Well, I think you're right. That's good. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on taking charge. And we'll be right back with Who Regulates Food Additives? What does that mean?
I'm going to read a portion of a letter to a bank from an irritated 86-year-old woman. I personally answer your telephone calls and letters, and when I try to contact you, I'm confronted by the impersonal, overcharging, pre-recorded, faceless entity which your bank has become. So from now on, I, like you, choose only to deal with a flesh and blood person. I will issue your designated employee to call me with a PIN number, which he or she must quote in dealings with me.
This is great.
I regret that it cannot be shorter than 28 digits. But again, I have modeled it on the number of button presses required of me to access my account balance on your phone bank service. As they say, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Let me level the playing field even further. When you call me, press buttons as follows. Immediately after dialing, press the star button for English. Press 1 to make an appointment to see me, 2 to query a missing payment, 3 to transfer the call to my living room in case I'm there, 4 to transfer the call to my bedroom in case I'm sleeping, press 5 to transfer the call to my toilet in case I'm attending to nature, press 6 to transfer my call to my mobile phone if I'm not at home, 7, to leave a message on my computer, a password to access my computer is required. To return to the main menu and to listen to options 1 through 9, you push 8. And number 9, to make a general complaint or inquiry. Now, the contact will then be put on hold pending the attention of my automated answering service. And while this may on occasion involve a lengthy wait, uplifting music will play for the duration of the call. Touche.
I'll say. Well, that would be great. I think once people get you and then you need their services, they treat you badly.
You know what I hate is when you call and you wait and you wait and you wait, and then you finally get somebody and you get disconnected, or while you're waiting you get disconnected.
Or it's the wrong place that you've been waiting.
They keep transferring you to somebody else, and then you lose the transfer.
There's a big difference between wooing you into whatever business it is that you're considering to work with them on, and then getting the service that they promised in a way that it really works for you. Big difference and big challenge.
Okay, so isn't it interesting how so many of us trust the ingredients in our food and assume that the additives must be safe or they wouldn't be in our food? Wrong. You know, we're going to talk about the conflicts of interest that are rampant in the food industry concerning food additives, things just like salt and trans fats and artificial flavors and food dyes, MSG, sweeteners,
right.
All those kind of things.
Right.
And FDA approval under GRAS, which means generally recognized as safe. So is the FDA doing its job to protect us?
Oh, not at all. They're hardly even evaluating, and that led some people actually looking into this and doing a study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association called Internal Medicine in August of 2013. And they found that 100% of all food additives that were FDA reports from 1997 to 2012 were made only by people associated with the food industry. So that tells you that these people who are forwarding reports to the FDA are only going to be trying to make sure that the product that they're involved with is going to be approved by them.
Well, it's like the makeup and the cosmetic industry, and the CIR, the people who make the assessments for safety, mm-hmm. manufacture the products.
Yeah. Well, you would think that we'd be protected. And it's shocking to really find out from a study like this that's published in a major peer-reviewed journal that that's not the case at all.
And then the inside experts.
Yeah. Well, they found that of the 451 voluntary reports, that they all had this conflict of interest. The companies were allowed to determine if additives were generally regarded as safe by proclamation, not by necessarily any studies. And they found that 43% of the 10,000 additives that are on the generally regarded as safe list, the manufacturers made their own safety determination on thousands.
And the reports are voluntary. They don't even have to do them.
Right. Well, of those reports, 22% were made by an employee, 13% were made by manufacturers that hired the firms. So you've got there 35% that were directly controlled by the company. And another 64% was made by expert panels that were selected by either the company itself or the manufacturer's hired firms. So we've got none of these reports from third parties that have no conflict of interest. So what's it telling you? How could the FDA be doing a good job? They don't even really have any power to try and do something about.
You know, no wonder we have so many chronic diseases.
Well, that's a good part of it.
The GRAS criteria was temporary in 1997, and it never was ever even finalized. Nobody was paying attention.
Well, that's the influence now of the food industry, okay, on the FDA.
And that's 15 years.
Well, that's right. You know, in this study, they said the good news was that once the FDA gets a documentation that's a voluntary one, it does its job and encourages a manufacturer of questionably safe additives to withdraw their notices. But what happens then? Nothing.
It's dropped.
So it's dropped. And so what's the point of it? There is no point of it except to tell we, the people, that our food isn't safe because nobody's regulating the additives that are put in it.
And the food safety is dependent on the integrity of the manufacturing companies, and we can't trust them because there's too much of a conflict of interest, and
right.
then nobody follows through.
So it's all about money. It's like so many things in our culture are about money and power, and that's what seems to run everything. And so what we do in business is not something that is the same thing that we look at as community values, but they're one and the same, and you can't exclude what we do in business and say, well, that doesn't count, because it does count. In fact, I think it counts the most because it reflects what you'll really do when you're pressed. You wouldn't want these people to be your winger if you were flying a fighter airplane.
I think there are things maybe to bring up here as far as food safety, because people need to educate themselves. Because obviously you can't count on the FDA or the manufacturers to protect you.
You can count on just the reverse, actually.
And this is why it's important the kind of meat you buy.
Oh, everything.
You know, that it's grass-fed and that the fish is not farm-raised. You
right.
need to ask if it's farm-raised or if it's wild fish.
Well, what about anything that comes in a package and it's got an ingredients list and it's got long names that you never
exactly.
heard of and don't know what they are? If you don't know what they are, I say don't buy it. Now, we do know what most of those things are, but if there's something there that I haven't seen before, there's no way I'm buying that product. In fact, in general, we shouldn't be buying those products at all, because these are foods that are refined and processed, that are hardly ever organic, and they've got all kinds of
additives. And what about when you go to a restaurant? You don't know what's in it when you go to a restaurant.
We actually do. you know that there's stuff in it that you don't want to hear about.
Oh, you know that there is. Yeah.
That's right, but you made the right point.
Well, the other thing is about shrimp. Shrimp can be suspicious. You know, many. It's important to know where food comes from.
Right.
And much of the shrimp and the prawns that come from Vietnam and Cambodia are farmed. And then to prevent disease and to increase their growth, they put chemicals and things in the water that are unhealthy and antifungals and pesticides growth stimulants and all this stuff that we do fish.
Well, they're trying to make a living and they want to make as much money as they can. And they don't really care what happens to people. And that's why we have so many problems with people having reactions to what they're eating and not getting the nutrients they need from food. And why there's so many foods that are not foods at all. They're now food products, not whole foods. If it looked like a watermelon or a strawberry or a zucchini, buy it.
Unless
that's going to be
unless
healthy.
It's genetically engineered. But see, that's another problem. And later on in the show, we're going to be talking about in vitro meat.
Could you believe that?
And slime, pink slime, and all that kind of stuff in the food, the high fructose corn syrup, all the things that are sneaked into a lot of foods too, even things that you think are healthy, like salad dressings and so forth.
Oh, yeah, they can be the worst. In fact, you almost have to make your own salad dressing.
But food colorings you need to be aware of, and so many kids are eating food colorings. You know, even bagels are food colored, and a lot of times, you know, depending on the flavor of it. So, a lot of things that people need to be aware of.
You know, that's over and above the kind of problems that we have because of our health, too. Look how many people are gluten sensitive or lactose intolerant or allergic to milk products, or they can't tolerate soy or
And many or people think and, that the genetically engineered food is making people more allergic.
Oh, well, that could be. I mean, you're putting something in a human body that's never been there before and is not part of nature. The arrogance we have from that is just a little bit too much for me. Well, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. And when we come back, we'll be talking about should the FDA speed approval for promising cancer drugs. So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health right after the station break. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Savuta here with Nurse Vicki.
Should we speed FDA approval for cancer drugs? Sounds good. Or does it? I mean, does it give patients real hope or false hope? If the drugs are new, does this mean that the patients are experiments? Does it make patients feel special to be on a new drug? If you had stage 4 cancer, would you do it as a last hope for a cure, even if it made you feel sick? Well, these are some things to think about. So tell us about the article in the New England Journal of Medicine about the small study on a new cancer drug for chronic lymphocytic leukemia and lymphoma.
It's interesting. You know, the depth of the collusion and the conflict of interest between the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA are extremely deep, and we've known about this for a long time. And here's one more classic example of how they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes and also show us the depth of the problems that there are, even including the New England Journal of Medicine, in my opinion. We definitely need to have something when we have a disease for which there's no clear cure. And we'd like to think that the research that's being done is research that we can trust because it's being done by people who care. But you have to keep in mind that the business of medicine is different from the service of medicine. And the results that come out are not always what you'd like to hear, because their goal is return on investment primarily, rather than what can we do to really provide solid, good approaches to help people with cancer.
Because what really does happen when they fast-track a drug through,
well,
far as money goes?
Well, the present way we have before this new approach that was trying to create a system where there's a breakthrough therapy designation pathway is what it's called, means there's just a way that they're talking about to bring drugs to market faster, actually already exists today. And in fact, what we have is a system where the pharmaceutical industry is allowed to pay the FDA millions of dollars if they'll fast track, meaning get their drug reviewed faster, and it sometimes saves a year or two, which means that they can bring these drugs to market a lot sooner.
So the pharmaceutical company is making a lot of money,
exactly.
Whereas normally they would be spending those extra 2 years on the research and doing the tests on the patients.
Exactly.
And also the FDA is making a big hunk of money. So
in
there's
that setting,
another conflict.
In that interest. Setting, that's correct. So what you have is a system that's not right. If you bring a drug to market 2 years sooner and it's making the predicted $5 billion a year that the drug that they're talking about bringing to market is, which is ibrutinib, that's about $10 million if it's 2 years sooner. They could afford to pay a lot of money to the FDA and to the New England Journal of Medicine. You know, I'm not accusing them of that, but I'm suspicious. The article that they published that was in the July 10th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine was written in a way that was confusing and difficult to really understand.
Because they don't want you to understand it.
I think that's what it's about. And it made it look like that the drug actually not just has promise, but is going to save lives and make the morbidity of the illness less.
But they don't really know. And so basically what's going on is that the patient that's getting the experimental drug is really still they're still the rat.
And this is typically what happened. I have patients come to me all the time saying, do you think I should be in a clinical trial for the illness that I have? It might be cancer. It might be some other thing like MS or whatever. And my answer usually is, let's take a look at what they're doing first. And then find out if this is something that's to your benefit or if it's to the benefit of the pharmaceutical industry and the people doing the research and to the institutions that are getting and sharing some of that money that's coming from Big Pharma.
So that you're not just a statistic.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's unfortunately what happens too often. So the relationships that we have go deep. And when you start talking about implying that the New England Journal of Medicine is not free of conflicts of interest, just look back at Marcia Angel, the MD from Harvard, who was the chief editor for the New England Journal of Medicine, who resigned her job a few years ago saying that the stuff coming across her desk was disappointing and disillusioning, and a lot of it shouldn't have been published.
So there's a conflict of interest with the journal.
Yep.
And with the
Probably.
FDA
yes.
between Big Pharma.
Yes.
So there's all these conflicts of interest and undue influence to make people think that these drugs are worth it to do. Now, of course, there would be times that there might be a drug
that
would be
part.
Worth it to fast track it through. But they're not mentioning anything about integrative oncology,
no.
about using
right.
alternatives to chemotherapy, because there's no money in that.
Right.
And there are things like fish oil and artemisinin and methyljasminate and vitamin C and so on and so forth.
Tons of things. Tons of things that are approaches that should be considered. And to me, it's outrageous that our oncologists are irresponsible about learning about complementary alternative approaches, particularly when they're safe and probably very effective a lot of the time.
And the other thing is that there are movies that make you kind of feel like, well, this is really important
you.
To do this. I just watched one not long ago that Harrison Ford was in, and he was some sort of a scientist.
Right.
And he helped these children that had a genetic disease, and it saved their life. And then look at the movie Lorenzo's Oil, and it can't help but make you wonder if the pharmaceutical company might have been one of the funders.
Well,
of
they
the
should
movie.
Have been if they weren't. And so here we are making all these accusations. But, you know, at the same time, you've got to look at the picture here. Because this is serious stuff, and a lot of money is at risk. But more than that, a lot of lives are at risk. When somebody's sick, we should look at all therapies that are conceivably possible to be of value. You know, when we get these arrogant doctors, a lot of them the research scientists, who say we have to have clinical trials that prove that the treatments we're using are effective, they don't realize that about
But that's for dangerous drugs. That's not for alternatives that aren't dangerous.
85% of what we do is not solid science, and there's a very small amount of research that can be trusted that's published in the major journals, according to the Office of Technology Assessment. So we have a serious problem here. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and we'll be back with Vicki's final 2020 tip called Just Stay. I wonder what that's all about. And also, we'll be talking about, are test tube burgers good for vegetarians? Are they good for anybody? And can sleep deprivation lead to junk food cravings?
stay. A nurse took this tired, anxious serviceman to the bedside. "Your son is here," she said to the old man. She had to repeat the word several times before the patient's eyes opened. Heavily sedated because of the pain of his heart attack, he dimly saw the young uniformed Marine standing outside the oxygen tent. He reached out his hand. The Marine wrapped his toughened fingers around the old man's limp ones, squeezing a message of love and encouragement. The nurse brought a chair so that the Marine could sit beside the bed. All through the night, the young Marine sat there in the poorly lighted ward, holding the old man's hand and offering him words of love and strength. Occasionally, the nurse suggested that the Marine move away and rest for a while, but he refused. Whenever the nurse came into the ward, the Marine was oblivious of her and of the night noises of the hospital, the clanking of the oxygen tank, the laughter of the night staff members exchanging greetings, the cries and moans of other patients. Now and then she heard him say a few gentle words. The dying man said nothing, only held tightly to his son all through the night. Along toward dawn, the old man died. The Marine released the now lifeless hand he'd been holding and went to tell the nurse. While she did what she had to do, he waited. Finally, she returned. She started to offer words of sympathy, but the Marine interrupted her. "Who was that man?" he asked. Well, the nurse was startled. "He was your father," she answered. "No, he wasn't," the Marine replied. "I never saw him before in my life."
Whoa.
"Then why didn't you say something when I took you to him?" "I knew right away there'd been a mistake, but I also knew he needed his son, and his son just wasn't there. When I realized that he was too sick to tell whether or not I was his son, knowing how much he needed me, I stayed. I came here tonight to find a Mr. William Gray. His son was killed in Iraq today, and I was sent to inform him." "What was this gentleman's name?" The nurse, with tears in her eyes, answered, "Mr. William Gray." So the next time somebody needs you, just be there and stay. And remember, we're not human beings going through a temporary spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings going through a temporary human experience.
Wow. That's so powerful. I mean, you're obviously a healer, Vicki, and such a great nurse. And that's maybe why you picked this story, because you're a lot like that, too. When you're with people who need you, you are right there, and your full focus is with them. And I've seen you in action with patients before, and it's amazing at how much you do that so givingly and so lovingly, because you feel like it's important and you're needed.
Well, thanks.
My hat's off to you. If I'm on my deathbed, I want you there.
Well, me too.
Actually, I was on it a couple of years ago, and you were there.
Thank you for that. You would be like that too. In fact, we were with a patient that we had that was dying of cancer that flew here before he died.
Oh,
remember that?
Yes.
Jerry.
Yeah, I sure do remember Jerry. What a story that was.
Yeah, he was in the Bahamas getting an alternative treatment for his cancer, and he ended up with pneumonia, and his wife called us from the Bahamas and said that...
They're flying him home.
They were flying him home, and it was really just to be with us, and we went over there like at 3 in the morning.
His plane arrived. He had a special flight just for him. He arrived at 3 in the morning.
In a helicopter.
Right.
Yeah, and we went, and we were just with him while he died and with her. But it was a beautiful experience.
Well, those are the moments in life that are so precious, where what we're interested in is giving, sharing, listening, caring. There's no return on investment.
And
it's
so
not about what you
and
get.
And so many times people worry about what they can do, and it's about being there. So,
yeah, it's about listening and caring and being present and sharing and loving. That's what we need to do to evolve to a human race that lives like that. And when we do, things will be much different than they are. I mean, we've been so dispersed and so traumatized by how our culture operates that it becomes a fight for a survival of the fittest. Who has the most money? Who has the most power? Who's got the best car? Who's the most competitive? Who's the best this or that? It's not about that at all. It's about who's present, who's listening, who's caring, who's supporting, who wants to connect just for the sake of supporting. And it's our system. It's our universe. And we're all part of it. And the oneness of it is far from being realized by how we run our lives. We need to remember that. This is a beautiful story, Vicki. Thank you so much for that.
Good. Okay. You know, first we have pink slime, which is...
Oh, there's a transition.
Which is goo from the odds and ends of the beef, including the meat that's shaved off the bone.
So you're talking about McDonald's burgers,
and
huh?
Sanitized with ammonium hydroxide. And now we have test tube protein burgers in the making. So how would you like to eat a fake beef burger grown from in vitro cattle stem cells? From the Petri dish into the frying pan. Yummy, yummy, yuck. Which is worse?
Well, I think actually there's a big difference. As bad as the McDonald's sounds, it's far better than
the pink slime.
Absolutely. Why? Because it's real meat to start with. It may not be the most appetizing part of it, and it's got this ammonium hydroxide in it, which is not something you'd like, and it doesn't look very good, and it doesn't taste that great. But when you're talking about test tube burgers, what are you talking about?
Well, I don't know. What happens if you eat stem cells?
Well, you're not just eating stem cells. You're eating what they create, which is strands of protein, about 20,000 strands of laboratory-grown protein combined with other ingredients to make what...
So those are amino acids.
All you're getting is just protein. You're not getting any antioxidants. You're not getting the...
I think I'd rather get the protein in a protein drink.
I think, yeah, there would be some similarities there, although the protein drink is probably better. There are at least 55 nutrients that are essential that if we don't get, we can't survive.
We'd rather drink the green slime than the pink slime.
Oh, there's a choice. Yeah.
Aren't we creative when it comes to food? You know, this is why other countries like Taiwan advertise no U.S. beef.
Well, yeah, you know, we criticize them for doing things like eating dogs and cats and things like that. A heck of a lot more healthy, even though it's repulsive for so many reasons. But think about the cattle industry in general. We raise these animals, we slaughter them, and then we do things to change around the goodness of what's natural, and we wind up... doing a lot of things that are not healthy for the environment.
So where are our standards anyway? I mean, it seems like, again, here we go, about it just being about money.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, it's not just about that, but you got a great point because it certainly is about money. But it's also about the fact that we slaughter millions of animals every year. And that's something that's not good. And we don't have enough protein to feed the world if we're going to get it from animals. So there's a limit to what we can do.
So
and we do need an alternative.
So we can have lab burgers.
Well, yeah.
And so they put a little salt and they put breadcrumbs and egg powder and beet juice and saffron in it. But
right.
They said that they still need to work on the flavor. Maybe they can add a little MSG to it.
Well, there you go. Well, see, it's about... how it looks and how it tastes, and that's how they approach the public. So what happened in this experiment, fortunately, is that when they're eating this in vitro protein strands, okay, with a few little things in it, it doesn't taste that good. And so a lot of the tasters want to hold back. But we shouldn't be looking at just how does it taste. It's like, is this really good for us? Is this going to give us the nutrients that we need?
Okay, so maybe we should talk about what's in real meat. What if you had a real hamburger that you made, well, like tonight I made one.
Yeah, right, you did.
Out of real grass-fed beef.
Exactly.
So grass-fed beef is leaner beef, and it's organic.
Uh-huh.
And so why is that healthy if you're not a vegetarian?
Okay, well, it's healthy even if you are.
But, I know, but okay. I mean, vegetarians...
They're not going to want it. Well, what about the minerals and vitamins, the antioxidants, the enzymes, the fats, and the essential nutrients that are in meat? That's the way Mother Nature made it. Now, when you're making it in a test tube, you can put all of those 55 essential factors in there? No, it's not going to happen. It's not the way Mother Nature made it. And do you think that we really understand what's in beef and how Mother Nature has assimilated it the way that it has? Not close. We don't even understand how cell metabolism works. There are tens of thousands of reactions occurring simultaneously. And when you just take one particular aspect, like the amino acids and put them in, it's like having a symphony made of 1,000 bass drums. You've taken care of one problem, but you've ignored all the others because you're not smart enough to know what's actually needed.
Okay, now, vegetarians often are looking for substitutes, like they'll eat soy burgers.
Right. They want their protein.
But sometimes those soy burgers, if you read the ingredients in them, they're really not healthy.
And what if they're not organic? I mean, you'd look at our genetically engineered.
So this one's talking about the things that they add to it, like egg powder and beet juice. Well, why not eat some eggs?
Well,
has protein.
Yeah, well, they're trying to make a product, okay, that you'll buy. So they want it to look good and they want it to taste good. And that's the bulk of what it is. Will you buy it? I mean, people will buy Twinkies. If they buy a Twinkie, they'll buy anything. I mean, even insects are smart enough not to eat that.
Okay, well, anyway, it does solve the problems of a few things, like raising animals and slaughtering them and pollution.
Yeah,
and
it does. Energy use and deforestation.
Land degradation.
Yeah, these are all big things. And the other good news is it probably won't come to market for about 20 years. And I'll tell you one thing.
We're going to be pretty old by then.
I think we'll be long gone by then. Well, maybe not.
My mother's 97, so.
Yeah, right. Well, that means we'll have a little bit more time. So I think that the whole emphasis on the test tube burger is something we better think about. And there are definitely ways that we can supply ourselves with the nutrients that we need by staying natural. And there are a lot of ways that we can encourage the production of food that's whole food that maybe is a little different. We got the whole sea that's full of food that's got all kinds of plant life there that's good for us.
Of course, that's pretty polluted too.
Well, yeah.
But beans are high in protein, beans and rice together.
There are lots of things that we can do that can give us all the nutrients we need in a natural way rather than going ahead and doing something that's flipped out of a test tube.
Okay, so if you're overweight and you're concerned about it, try getting more sleep.
How's that work?
You know, we've talked about how sleep deprivation can increase our appetite because of insulin and leptin resistance. But now a new study from UC Berkeley shows that it also affects our brains.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about lack of sleep affecting the reward centers in our brains, causing us to crave junk food like slime burgers and and test tube burgers.
Anything that tastes
over
good.
Healthy foods.
Well, it's all about taste, Vicki. If we like the taste and it's full of calories, we tend to like stuff like that. And then
but it's interesting that not getting enough sleep makes us crave it, like donuts and pizza over whole grains and leafy green vegetables.
Well, you're right. And this was a study that was done out of the University of California in Berkeley. And it was published in a journal called Nature Communications in July of 2013. And it basically said what you said, that insomnia increases the preference for junk food and whole as opposed to whole foods.
And also our motivation and our desire are amplified as well.
Right. And so the way it actually works is that it's affecting the brain centers. The frontal lobe usually makes complex decisions about what we should or shouldn't eat. And when we're not getting enough sleep, the functional MRIs that can tell you where brain activity is the most will show you that the frontal lobes are pretty much dulled. There's not much activity going on there. And yet the deeper centers in the brain that are more about responding to rewards are showing something quite different. And that's that we really want to eat the things that taste the best and that seem to have the most calories. So it's an interesting addition to showing how insomnia has an effect on what our appetite is like.
Yes, because these findings show the specific brain mechanism for why the food choices change for the worse.
Well, it's another specific mechanism. The one you talked about during the introduction of this topic.
About the leptin and the insulin.
When we're under inflammation for any reason, whether it be lack of sleep, no exercise, stress, a diet that's not healthy for us, being overweight, being exposed to toxic things in the environment, our level of inflammation goes up, and when it does, it results in the resistance of insulin and the resistance of leptin. Now, what does that mean? If we have insulin resistance, it means that the insulin isn't going to be able to handle the blood sugar load that we have with normal amounts of insulin. We have to produce more. And when we do, It forces the sugar in our bloodstream into our cells where we can metabolize it, but it also causes problems with hypertension, high triglycerides. It can put us at risk for heart attacks and strokes, and it will speed the conversion of sugar, of sugar into fat. And so all those things are not a good thing from the point of view of insulin and from the point of view of leptin resistance. Leptin is that hormone that regulates our appetite, and it's in our fat cells. So when we eat, the fat cells in our body release leptin. It goes to our brain. It quiets down our appetite center so we don't crave food, and we feel full. We're satiated.
Maybe this is why when kids have slumber parties, they eat all this junk food.
Well, that would be one reason. I think that's right. But there are other reasons why, too. I mean, they just like it, and they're growing, and, of course, they can eat it, and it doesn't affect them so much with being overweight as it does with growth, which is what they're doing. That's the big thing that kids are doing.
Which is why it's even more important to get enough sleep and to eat a healthy diet.
Yeah, exactly. So this whole business of sleep deprivation being linked to junk food cravings is one that adds more information to what we know about how our appetite works. Of course, the other thing is that if you don't sleep well, there's so many other things that are problems. I mean, you don't function well because you're tired. A lot of auto accidents and other kinds of job injuries occur. You don't feel good. You tend to make mistakes in what you do. The quality of your life is terrible. We need 8 hours of sleep. 7 to 8, I'd say, is what we need in general. And if we don't get that, these are the things that happen. And in America, we're all in this fast-track-driven work or culture where we're always in a hurry.
Well, we're always running out of time, and so that's why many people don't get enough sleep. And then look at all the time people spend, you know, on the road commuting.
Oh, right. I mean, there's some people commuting 2 or 3 hours in each direction. And so that leads to all kinds of health problems.
So we need to set our sleeping patterns as a priority and do everything we can to
Well, if you want to feel good and be healthy, I mean, sleep is a must. Look at how many people can't sleep, the insomniacs of the world. And it's usually because there's a problem that is emotional that keeps them from sleeping.
Or they have a spouse that snores or has restless leg syndrome.
What are you trying to tell me? Nothing's sacred in this marriage, is it?
I didn't say it was you.
No, who are you sleeping with?
I said some people.
I see. Okay.
So if you want to admit it, you're doing it, not me.
Oh, I get it. Okay. Yeah, well, and of course, if you have pain, that's something that people that keeps them awake. Or people that have sleep apnea, we see that too. But the big thing is that people usually can't sleep because they're all revved up. We got too much going. We're in the fast track. Or we're depressed, and there are different patterns of sleep that are almost diagnostic of what that means in terms of what's going on. So,
of whether you go to sleep right away or whether you wake up and can't go back to sleep.
That's right. So if you can't get to sleep, it's usually because there's a lot on your mind. So you're anxious and stressed, and you want things to come out differently than they are, so you keep perseverating them. But if you wake up early and you can't go back to sleep, say you wake up at 5 in the morning and you can't sleep anymore, that's usually a sign of depression.
It also might be a sign you need to go to the bathroom.
Well, yeah, but you should be able to go back to sleep if you get up and go to the bathroom.
Well, iPads are helpful and earplugs are helpful.
Well, these are good tips to help ensure good sleep.
Yep.
So I think we need to pay attention to the way we run our lives and start doing things that make a lot more sense that will give us better quality of life because we feel good.
And some people that take sleeping pills walk in their sleep and then they go eat too much. In the middle of when they're
no way to win. And, of course, sleeping pills brings up a whole other topic. We tend to depend on those rather than get the natural sleep that we need to have and solve the underlying reasons for why we don't sleep. If we paid more attention to why we don't sleep and looked into those factors, we'd then be able to not only sleep well, but we wouldn't have to be under the effects of the drugs that we're using that really don't solve the problem and have so many side effects that it leads to lots of other problems. Okay, we're at the end of the show and want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news in health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com. from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
If you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Enjoy. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.